Chapter 4, Picking Up the Pieces, The Birth of a U.S. Bioweapons Program. The Universities. While World War II still raged, and word of Japan's successful deployment of bioweapons reached Allied governments, the Soviet Union, Great Britain, and the United States began committing significant resources to researching chemical and biological weaponry. As with their Japanese and German predecessors, U.S. bioweaponeers cultivated a symbiotic alliance with medical universities. In 1941, following the Japanese plague atrocities in China, U.S. Secretary of War Henry Stimson convened at the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C., a group of prominent scientists to commission a literature search to determine the feasibility of bioweapons, dubbed the War Bureau of Consultants, WBC Committee. The biologists came from universities that would maintain enduring and immensely lucrative partnerships with the bioweapons industry. John Hopkins, Yale, Harvard, Rockefeller Institute, University of Chicago, and University of Wisconsin. 2 months later, on February 17, 1942, the academics returned with an enthusiastic endorsement. The medical scholars, as Ed Regis points out in The Biology of Doom, had discovered that the world of science was full of proposals for the intentional dissemination of noxious microbes as a means of killing or incapacitating the enemy. Brushing off any ethical dilemma, the professors exuberantly endorsed this promising new line of weaponry from which their institutions would almost immediately begin profiting immensely. Biological warfare is regarded as distinctly feasible, they gushed. We are of the opinion that steps should be taken to formulate offensive and defensive measures. The committee added a sophomoral incantation that would persistently pose as a pretext among death scientists. In biological warfare, the best defense is offense and the threat of offense. That's a quote. Let me read that again. In biological warfare, the best defense is offense and the threat of offense, end quote. The exhilarating potential of killing millions of civilians seems to have unhinged these academics from moral restraints. They rhapsodized about sabotaging milk supplies with typhoid, polluting reservoirs with botulinum, releasing diphtheria into shelters, bus stations, movie theaters, factories, and stores, smearing microbes onto subway strap handles to murder commuters, and infesting cities with plague-contaminated rats. The prospect of mass murder had proven a surprising catalyst for their superior brains. The War Department rewarded the universities for this optimistic assessment by paying their biologists to investigate various agents. The National Institutes of Health committed to studying the cholera and typhus. Harvard Medical School agreed to investigate dysentery. Cornell worked on anthrax, and the University of Cincinnati adopted tularemia. Michigan State College took on brucellosis, Northwestern muscle toxins, Notre Dame rickettsiae, and so on. In a typical experiment, the United States Navy and the University of California, Berkeley recruited 50 San Quentin convicts as guinea pigs in a bubonic plague experiment. By the mid-1960s, following Ishii's example, the Pentagon and CIA were contracting research in biological and chemical weapons to universities and pharmaceutical companies. Universities thus played a key role in bioweapons development from the outset. Their reliance on federal scientific research funding now accounts for some 60% of university research, far eclipsing their revenue from tuition. This reliance made them inevitable partners in the programs that help develop the COVID-19 virus, in the coercive vaccination policies they forced upon their students, and in academic participation in the COVID origin cover-up. As in fascist Germany and Japan, the gravities of power, money, power, and professional prestige associated with bioweapons development would draw academics from their ivory towers and cause them to shed the impediments of moral ballast with dismaying alacrity. The pharmaceutical industry was another key partner in the enterprise. With the academics' endorsement in hand, President Franklin Roosevelt appointed pharma titan George W. Merck to direct a newly created civilian agency called the War Research Service, or WRS, and moved him to a new office at the National Academy of Sciences in Washington. Merck simultaneously owned and ran the pharmaceutical company that still bears his name, inaugurating the long bioweapons partnership between pharma and the Pentagon. In a January 3, 1945 report to the United States Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, Merck acknowledges his reliance on the Japanese war criminals whose energy and ingenuity had fostered offensive developments in this field from 1936 until as late as 1945. At Fort Detrick, Merck built on Japanese discoveries to develop methodologies for culturing weapons-grade anthrax, brucellosis, botulism, and other deadly bioweapons. Colonel William Cabrich, recruited plant bacteriologist and chairman of the University of Wisconsin's Bacteriology Department, Dr. Ira L. Baldwin, then 47, to serve as the leader of the scientific division of the biological warfare program during World War II. Baldwin, the grandson of a Methodist minister, readily enlisted in the effort to produce microbes that could kill great numbers of human beings. Afterward, he described the simple formula he invoked to overcome his brief struggles with the ethical dilemma. Quote, It only took me about 24 hours to think my way through it. After all, the immorality of war is war itself. You start out with the idea in war of killing people, and that to me is the immoral part of it. It doesn't make much difference how you kill them. End quote. On December 21, 1942, Baldwin arrived at his new assignment at Edgewood Arsenal in Maryland. 3 months later, in March of 1943, under his direction, the United States Army purchased the 154-acre site at Camp Detrick, a National Guard airstrip near Frederick, Maryland, and transformed it into the United States Army Biological Warfare Laboratories, or USBWL. Baldwin quickly equipped a 50,605-square-foot hangar on the Detrick airfield with the two plants that made anthrax and botulinum toxins. The larger plant had a 10,000-gallon fermenter and two 3,700-gallon fermenters. In 1961 and 1962, Baldwin would further distinguish his peculiar place in history as the former scientific director at Fort Detrick by aiding Monsanto's smear campaign against Rachel Carson with a negative review of her book, Silent Spring, entitled Chemicals and Pests. That's the end of chapter 4. So I'm going to go on and read chapter 5. Chapter 5, Downloading Ishii and His Henchmen, Japan's Paperclip. In December 1949, Pravda reported that the United States was actively engaged in biological weapons development and had employed numerous Japanese war criminals, Unit 731 veterans, to develop biological weapons in United States labs. After initially denying Russian accusations, the United States government finally admitted in 1998 that the CIA did indeed provide positions to Unit 731 officers and medical researchers at labs in East Asia. There they helped Americans conceive and carry out experiments on human subjects that could not be conducted legally in the United States. The U.S. efforts to recruit Unit 731 doctors and researchers are still veiled in deep secrecy. As the Russians moved to occupy Manchuria at the tail end of World War II in August 1945, Ishii fled back to Japan, carrying thousands of tissue cultures and thousands of slides from autopsies, records of medical research, and biological analyses from human and animal experiments, all of which he stashed in caves, tombs, and temples of Japan on his journey south to Tokyo. In September 1945, within a month after the Japanese surrender, the first of four successive investigating teams from Fort Detrick visited Japan to interview Detachment 731's physicians and scientists and to collect their data, including autopsy reports, thousands of specimen slides, and other materials. The first to arrive in Japan was Murray Sanders, a Fort Detrick microbiologist who had taught at Columbia University. He quickly realized that Shiro Ishii was the compelling force behind Japanese biological warfare. His efforts to find and interview Ishii were fruitless. By November 1945, Ishii had hightailed it to his childhood province, where, with the help of local officials and family and friends, he elaborately falsified his own death, including a fake funeral with paid mourners and newspaper obituaries, incense, prayers, and offerings in his home village of Chiyotomura. From its Tokyo headquarters, the United States Army Counterintelligence Corps nevertheless uncovered the fraud, and a week later, in January 1946, located and detained Ishii for questioning. Robert McQuayle, an Army intelligence agent involved in his capture, described Ishii as a thoroughly frightened individual. During the next 4 weeks of interrogation, Ishii and his interrogator, biological weapons specialist Lieutenant Colonel Arvo T. Thompson, developed a congenial relationship. Still, Thompson reported that Ishii was holding back important information. Camp Dietrich sent out a third expedition. By this point, the Russians were trying and executing Unit 731 participants, eventually holding more than 2,000 separate judicial proceedings involving Japanese war criminals. The Soviets were in a frenzy to get Ishii in the dock. Norbert H. Fell, a bacteriologist who was chief of the plant engineering division at Fort Detrick, arrived in Japan on April 15, 1947, to escalate Ishii's questioning. Fell and McQuayle promised Ishii that his disclosures would not be used against him in regard to war crimes. They assured him that they only wanted to talk to him from a purely scientific standpoint, a code phrase that Ishii took as a guarantee against prosecution or punishment. Sensing the value of his research information to his American captors, Ishii asked for a job with the United States as a bioweapons expert and diplomatic immunity for himself, his superiors, and subordinates. Lured by these promises, United States authorities allowed Ishii to stay at his private property and to treat them with haughty imperiousness as they questioned, but never arrested him. In return, Ishii disclosed his stash sites in Japan's southern temples and mountains, allowing Fort Detrick crews to recover and store more than 15,000 slides from more than 500 of the 850 human corpses autopsied by Japanese scientists. They photomicrographed the slides and compared and translated the autopsy reports, along with descriptions of the laboratory protocols and case histories. In contrast to the Americans, the Soviets wanted to prosecute the Japanese Unit 731 leaders for their role in war crimes. But the American biological warfare scientists, in their rush to get scientific data, showed no evidence of any moral, legal, or other constraints. They coached Ishii on how to lie to the Russians, who were prosecuting Ishii's scientists as war criminals in the Khabarovsk trial. Khabarovsk's trial that began in December 1949. Ishii's final interrogator, MIT graduate Edwin V. Hill, MD, chief of basic sciences at Fort Detrick, said that Ishii's bioweapons treasure trove represented data that had been obtained by Japanese scientists at the expenditure of many millions of dollars and years of work. Hill wrote in a memo, "It is hoped that the individuals who voluntarily contributed this information will be spared embarrassment because of it." Knowing the value of the information the Japanese Army had collected, the United States played a key role in concealing information about biological warfare experiments. This resultant culture of secrecy would pervade the United States bioweapons program for the next 70 years and lay the groundwork for future collaborations, such as those with the Chinese scientists of the Wuhan Institute of Virology, once the United States occupation of Japan ended. Ishii reportedly visited the United States in 1959 as part of an extended tour that included a series of lectures at Fort Detrick. Ishii's cohorts were neither charged with war crimes nor put on trial in the United States. The United States built its biological weapons program based on the data and files obtained from Shiro Ishii's Japanese laboratory. Japanese scientists and historians have attested that United States guarantees of immunity, protection, and papers to the Unit 731's doctors and personnel were so widespread as to be nearly universal. A pharmacist, Meguro Masahiko, who had been attached to the laboratory at Dalian, China, described payments of hush money to Unit 731 members. Quote, "After the war, there were fantastic payments to former Unit 731 members. Some people got up to 2 million yen. That kind of money was unheard of in those days. Almost without exception, anyone connected in any way at all with Unit 731 got something. That was the best paying job there was. A lot of university professors were connected with Unit 731, especially the upper level people, like in the Ministry of Health and Welfare and those concerned with vaccines. They all had some connection with the Ishii unit in some way. They never said anything about it, but they all received pay for working there. Those are the people who built the foundation of today's Japan." End quote. In Unit 731 cover-up, the Operation Paperclip of the East, historians Hattie Beckham and Mirza Pyakkanen observe that, quote, "The researchers who worked at Unit 731, the Biological and Chemical Warfare Research and Development Unit, were given immunity in exchange for their research data. It is unmistakable that the Japanese BW scientists were given significantly much more allowance than their Nazi counterparts. End quote. In the 1980s, when the activities of Unit 731 finally came to light, Japanese citizens were shocked to discover that the most vicious and homicidal of the unit's war criminals had resurrected themselves as the leading lights of the nation's medical hierarchy. Hal Gold provides a partial list of Unit 731 alumni who went on to occupy preeminent leadership positions across Japan's medical establishment, including influential posts as deans of Japan's most prestigious medical schools, colleges, and universities, the presidents of the nation's leading hospital systems, emeritus professors of virology, immunology, and infectious diseases, revered vaccine developers, CEOs of Japan's top pharmaceutical companies and its medical and scientific research laboratories, the presidents of its most esteemed and influential medical associations, and top-level bureaucrats and scientists at the government health departments, including the National Institutes of Health, the NIH. And that's the end of Chapter 5. I am going to go on and read Chapter 6. Chapter 6, Operation Paperclip. In 1945, the United States military and intelligence agencies launched Operation Paperclip, a network of so-called rat lines that would eventually smuggle some 1,600 German chemists, biologists, and engineers, many of them high-level Nazi Party officials wanted for war crimes, from under the noses of Nuremberg prosecutors to cushy sinecures in United States chemical and biological weapons laboratories. Military and intelligence officials equipped those renegades with immunity and new identities in exchange for work on the top-secret government projects in the United States. In its natal stages, the Joint Chiefs of Staff ran Operation Paperclip somewhat lackadaisically under an ad hoc project dubbed the Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency, or the JIOA. Paperclip didn't really take off until the CIA took control in 1947. Immediately after Congress created the spy agency from the ashes of the disbanded OSS, that's period there, sorry. Let me read that again. Paperclip didn't really take off until the CIA took control in 1947, immediately after Congress created the spy agency from the ashes of the disbanded OSS. Bioweapons research and development were therefore baked into the CIA's DNA from the agency's inception. In its first 3 months, the CIA adopted the mission of developing a link between scientific planning and military research on a national scale, recounts historian Annie Jacobson in Operation Paperclip, quote, "In Operation Paperclip, the CIA found a perfect partner in its quest for scientific intelligence, and it was in the CIA that Operation Paperclip found its strongest supporting partner yet," end quote. One of the earliest requests that the agency issued was for biographical records of approximately 18,000 German scientists. A CIA monograph that remained classified under September 2008 read, "Priority was accorded to atomic energy, biological warfare, chemical warfare, electronic warfare, guided missiles, aircraft, undersea warfare, and medicine." The CIA's Special Operations Division, or SOD, opened a classified facility in a nondescript structure at Fort Detrick, cryptically dubbed Building 439. and funded the top secret program through the clandestine service's black budget. Building 439 was a low yellow concrete block structure that was identical in outside appearance to all the others on the base. The facility included a state-of-the-art bioweapons facility, including a germ lab, nicknamed Black Maria, equipped with the world's biggest aerosol chamber, a 1 million-liter steel golf ball called the 8-Ball, weighing 131 tons. The spies agency field operatives teamed up with senior bacteriologists in the Army Chemical Corps at Fort Detrick. The CIA opened its first overseas station in the notorious IG Farben building in Frankfurt and remained there throughout the Cold War. Senior CIA spies occupied the former offices of IG Farben board members and CIA CEO, who were then imprisoned at Spandau after the special IG Farben trial. Paperclip rushed to offer contracts to the worst of them while they were still in prison. Sorry, let me read that again. I'm not doing that right. Let's see. The CIA opened its first overseas station in the notorious IG Farben building in Frankfurt and remained there throughout the Cold War. Senior CIA spies occupied the former offices of IG Farben board members and CEO, who were then imprisoned at Spandau after the special IG Farben trial. Paperclip rushed to offer contracts to the worst of them while they were still in prison, including board members Karl Crouch, Göring's plenipotentiary for chemical production. In 1947, the 8-Ball's project manager, Dr. Harold Batchelor, recruited the superstar of the death sciences, Dr. Kurt Blohm, who had worked directly under Hermann Göring as the architect of the Reich's biological warfare program, to assist in its design and construction. Blohm was a hardcore Nazi ideologue and member of Hitler's inner circle, meeting frequently with Göring, Himmler, and Hitler. In a November 1942 memo to a Reich governor in Poland, Blohm had recommended the murder of 35,000 Poles diagnosed with tuberculosis. Blohm's biological talents had allowed the Nazis to develop a diabolical arsenal of weaponized pathogens, including cholera, parrot virus, and plague. The CIA was particularly interested in Blohm's preoccupation with developing biological assassination weapons, an enthusiasm he pursued at a speedily engineered bioweapons laboratory in Posen. The activity here was not to cause an epidemic amongst the population, merely to kill certain people, Blohm explained. The CIA also recruited Blohm's deputy, Dr. Erich Traub, a pre-Reich researcher at the Rockefeller Institute, who purportedly escaped from Russia with a cache of deadly pathogenic cultures. Traub began his career as a veterinarian and ended up working for Heinrich Himmler on Rinderpest and other animal pathogens. The CIA put Traub to work in its anti-animal weapons lab at Fort Detrick and at Plum Island, from which many believe Lyme disease later escaped. His job was to develop ways of decimating specific animal populations under Rinderpest, hoof and mouth disease, Newcastle disease, African swine fever, fowl malaria, and fowl plague. By 1952, Paperclip had imported approximately 600 Nazi scientists to the nation. By 1952, Paperclip had imported approximately 600 Nazi scientists to the United States. Like Blohm, many of the CIA's paperclip recruits were Nazi ideologues who served in Hitler's SS, rubbed shoulders with Hitler's inner circle, and were guilty of odious war crimes. Another of the agency's early trophies was the Reich's director of science, Major General Dr. Walter Schreiber, who reported directly to Goring. Schreiber was in charge of vaccines, antidotes, and serums for biological weapons. He was a self-proclaimed expert in winter warfare, desert warfare, vaccines, and bioweapons, including bubonic plague. Schreiber oversaw typhus experiments that infected men at Buchenwald and Nazweiler death camps. His subordinates dissected patients alive and performed hideous and deadly experiments. He oversaw live surgeries on anesthetized subjects, including kicking, screaming young Polish girls who were held down by SS troops and forcibly operated on. Schreiber only narrowly escaped the fate of his colleague, Goring's ordnance expert Field Marshal Willem Keitel, who worked on delivery systems for biological bombs. Keitel was hanged at Nuremberg. Schreiber was taken by the Russians and remained in Soviet custody for 3.5 years before defecting to the West and with paperclip. United States Army intelligence put Schreiber in charge of the health and well-being of the Soviet spies being interrogated and tortured during the mind control experiments at the CIA's first offshore black site, Camp King, the former Nazi prison torture chamber in Western Germany. Wehrmacht Generalist Walter Schreiber is not to be confused with another paperclip luminary with a similar name, the IG Farben Liaison and SS Brigadefuhrer Walter Schreiber, a Nazi Bonzen, Big Wheel, who wore the Golden Party badge. Schreiber was a loyal SS man in Hitler's inner circle and served in Heinrich Himmler's personal staff. Schreiber personally conducted sadistic experiments on slave labor crews, starving to death 116 in one hideous experiment, and oversaw design and construction of armaments factories in concentration camps. Schreiber killed perhaps thousands more in chemical weapons tests at IG Farben's production plants. He was both Speer's liaison to IG Farben and an IG Farben employee with responsibility for overseeing the Reich's nerve gas production facility. After Schreiber and his team of Farben chemists shared the Nazis' sarin gas secrets with Fort Detrick officials, the Defense Department built massive production facilities at Muscle Shoals and Rocky Mountain Arsenal and began producing thousands of tons of lethal effluvia. The CIA also helped to free Dr. Otto Ambros, Hitler's favorite chemist, who served as the general manager of the Buna factory at Auschwitz, where Farben maintained a regular rotation of thousands of slaves, at least 25,000 of whom he worked to death. Ambros was the co-developer of sarin gas. The Nuremberg Tribunal convicted him of mass murder and slavery and sentenced him to 8 years, but thanks to intervention by Operation Paperclip officers, he served only 2.5 at Landsberg Prison. Without officially joining his fellow Nazi weaponeers at Fort Detrick, Ambros benefited from the liberal and respectful treatment that powerful paperclip officials made de rigueur for Nazi chemists. That was my kitty. Sorry, she's sleeping. Following his release, Ambrose enjoyed a cushy life, serving on the boards of U.S. military contractors and chemical companies with close relationships with the CIA and Pentagon, including W.R. Grace. Ambrose additionally served on the boards of several private corporations and about a half dozen corporations owned by the Federal Republic of Germany. He also consulted with Dow Europe of Switzerland, Knoll, a pharmaceutical subsidiary of BASF, which eventually merged into IG Farben, and with the United States Department of Energy. In the 1950s, Ambrose became chairman of the advisory committee for a German pharmaceutical company, Chemie Grünenthal, which made itself a refuge for a snake pit of top Nazis. According to Jacobson, Chemie Grünenthal played the key role in developing and marketing thalidomide, which caused profound birth defects that included missing limbs in over 10,000 children. Laser-focused on the emerging Soviet threat, Alan Dulles, the CIA's first civilian director, believed it strategically necessary to overlook important scientists' involvement in Nazi and Japanese atrocities. General Stephen Chamberlain expressed the consensus among Dulles's powerful Georgetown set when he declared that America had the Soviets to fear, not the Nazis. In 1945, after the Russian occupation of East Germany, the Soviet version of Paperclip, Operation dismantled the entire IG Farben gas production lab at Dyrenfurth, captured its chemists, and reassembled the whole shebang outside Stalingrad. The Soviets' successful efforts to appropriate... My eyes are getting tired of looking at the print. Okay. The Soviets' successful efforts to appropriate Reich bioweapons scientists like Dr. Eugen Hagen stimulated the United States' competitive juices and served as an impetus for the acceleration of the paperclip program. The Soviet Union's June 1948 Berlin blockade, Russia's detonation of their first atomic bomb in 1949, and the 1950 Korean War all energized the CIA's efforts to recruit German scientists. Paperclip's illegal exoneration of the worst war criminals and its outlaw Camp King torture and drug experiments on captured Soviet spies made it a rogue clandestine operation from the start. In 1952, the West German government warned High Commissioner John McCloy that Operation Paperclip violated NATO regulations and America's own policies for governing Germany. The Joint Chiefs of Staff backed away from the program, and the CIA took control, redoubling past paperclip efforts to recruit Nazi scientists and intelligence officers. In 1963, the FBI learned that the GIOA director, Lieutenant Colonel Henry Whalen, was a Soviet spy. The Pentagon officially disbanded the GIOA, the official paperclip agency, tried and sentenced Whalen in secret, and rebranded Operation Paperclip as the cutting-edge science agency, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA, later renamed DARPA. Oh boy, DARPA. Okay, here we go. Sorry for the editorializing here. It's hard not to conclude that the men who gravitated to the bioweapons field were often ethically unhinged. One paperclip official who was active in both Germany and Japan was Colonel Charles Lokes. Paperclip dispatched Colonel Lokes first to Japan to oversee and study the effects of incendiary bombs, and then to Germany to recruit biochemical weapons scientists. As commander of the Rocky Mountain Arsenal during World War II, Lokes was in charge of manufacturing mustard gas and industrial-scale production of incendiary bombs, with which the United States emulated the German Culture Center, Dresden, and 67 Japanese cities, causing up to 1 million Japanese civilian casualties. Had the United States lost the war, Lokes would certainly have been executed for war crimes. Incendiary weapons are banned by the Geneva Protocol of 1925. Lokes also served as the United States Army's chief chemical officer in Tokyo after the war, when he presumably met the Unit 731 survivors while touring the countryside, visiting the remains of the cities he had helped incinerate. A photograph depicts him standing proudly beside a neatly stacked heap of charred bodies of civilians, holding the casing of an incendiary from his Rocky Mountain arsenal. Quote, They stacked them up in this big high pile. I had a picture of me standing beside them because I had been responsible for the manufacturing of the bombs that killed them. End quote. Lokes added a comment that spotlights his own moral indifference to the gruesome outcome of his handiwork. That was just one of those incidents that didn't mean anything, but I just happened to see what happened to some of our incendiary bombs that were over there. Lokes's troubling detachment exemplifies a consistent trait among bioweaponeers: the capacity to view living human beings as scientific problems and the multitudes of dead as the measure of success, a moral indifference qualifying as sociopathy. Lokes was the beau ideal of the bioweapons set. He loved to entertain high-level and ardent Nazis like Walter Schreiber in his home. Jacobson recounts that when Lokes met a Nazi, he looked straight at the man and saw only the scientist. Among Lokes's close friends was his paperclip recruit Friedrich Fritz Hoffmann, who had managed a chemical laboratory at University of Würzburg that manufactured hundreds of tons of Tabin and sarin gases. I don't know if it's Tabin or Tabin. Tabin and sarin gases. Once in America, Hoffmann synthesized Nazi nerve gas stockpiles and worked on the CIA's assassination by poison program. Colleagues describe him as the CIA's poison master. And that is the end of chapter 6. And we will get to chapter 7 next time. So thanks for listening. That was 3 chapters, chapters 4, 5, and 6.